This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about an unconstitutional new piece of legislation just passed in Pennsylvania. It's called the Revictimization Release Act.
Aimed at Mamiya to try and stop his speaking and writing, it will apply to hundreds, perhaps thousands of others, and prevent us from learning about what is going on in prisons throughout the United States.
We'll hear excerpts from a talk by Professor Richard Falk on the Palestinian future after Gaza.
If you're wondering what's going to happen next after the massacre that the Israelis called Protective Edge, listen to this informative, remarkable talk.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, I heard that President Obama might be opening the door for the U.S. to conduct torture outside of the United States.
You know, I read the article recently in the New York Times by Charlie Savage, and what he talks about in that article is that the U.S. may try and say that the Convention Against Torture's prohibitions, but particularly the one on what you could call torture light, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, which of course is what they always try and say they're doing rather than torture, they're trying to say that that does not apply overseas. So that if you look at a place like Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib or waterboarding, the argument that the Bush administration gave initially is the Convention Against Torture, the treaty, doesn't prohibit that conduct because that conduct is occurring overseas. And they tried to, it's a little complicated, they tried to say, well, while torture may be prohibited overseas, cruel, inhuman, and degrading isn't prohibited, and that things like waterboarding, those are not really torture, they're torture light. But in any case, the bottom line to this is, once Obama took office, we sort of understood that torture light, whatever you call it, would not be permitted overseas, that the torture convention, which prohibits it overseas, clearly would be interpreted by the administration as to say, it bans torture overseas. And Obama actually issued an executive order when he took office saying that torture is not permitted overseas, no kind of cruelty is permitted overseas. And that was in 2009 when he took office. And all of a sudden now this issue has come up. It's come up in part because the U.S. has to go before the United Nations in November on its periodic reporting of how it has complied with the Convention Against Torture, which the U.S. has been a signatory to and ratified some almost 20 years ago. And so preparing for that hearing in front of the United Nations, the U.S. has to come up with their interpretation of the treaty. And what you read in the Savage article in the Times is there's a lot of debate in the administration now, particularly apparently from the military and the CIA, saying we don't want the prohibition in the Convention Against Torture, the prohibition on torture to encompass torture carried out overseas. And they're actually debating that within the White House. And so I, as of course a lawyer who's been litigating this issue at the center, and a lot of us have, for many years, from Abu Ghraib to Guantanamo, otherwise, we're flabbergasted by this. How could you open a hole like that in the torture convention or in what you might do? Heidi, yes.
Michael, a technical question. Is there any way to know currently how much torture the U.S. is carrying out internationally versus domestically? I would assume a lot of it is on foreign soil.
The answer is we don't know, Heidi. Part of the answer is, of course, Obama banned almost all forms of torture. And CIA people have generally been recently reluctant to engage in torture unless they have what's called a legal golden shield. And part of the legal golden shield under Bush was that we're not going to say this convention applies overseas. And they got a legal interpretation from John Yoo, who was working at the Office of Legal Counsel, et cetera, who said, well, what you're doing doesn't violate the statute or the treaty, rather, because it applied overseas. So the question you're asking, we don't have an answer to. We do know this, that when Obama in 2009 prohibited torture both here and abroad, he did allow one loophole. It's called Annex M of the Army Field Manual. And that allows three techniques to be used: sleep deprivation, isolation, and sensory deprivation. And those three would you know, it depends on how they're used, but certainly taken together, most people would say they constitute torture. And so there is that hole in there, and we don't know to what extent that's being used. We don't know, you know, what's happened with that. All of us who have been opposing torture from the very inception have been trying to get them to remove Annex M from the allowable claims.
And I'm also curious about the practice of extraordinary rendition, because if we let someone go to a country where we know they'll be tortured, is that also sort of an exemption informally that we've been doing?
Well, we certainly did that under Bush. And we lost the case in which we said when they sent someone abroad for torture, that was somehow illegal. And the court said, well, it may be illegal, but at the time they did it, it wasn't clearly illegal to do it. So we lost the case on that. What this is really part of the rampant exemption both Bush and now Obama have given for those who tortured in the past, for those who might be torturing now, and for those who will torture in the future.
I think also it's an indication of the power of the CIA and the military.
I think that's right, Michael. I mean, look at Obama, as I said in a last piece I did on this, is a person with feet of clay, which is to say he can't move at all. He doesn't move. He has feet of clay. But at the same time, he is moving in a context of CIA and militarism that has increased dramatically. It's always been very strong, but has just swept aside, I think, any kind of reliance on constitutional rights or anything else. It's military CIA first, and after that we'll worry about the Constitution. Now, this law, as I said, if they get their way, they're going to gut the Convention Against Torture. Because if it just applies here in the United States and not overseas, so it wouldn't apply in Abu Ghraib, it wouldn't apply in our detention facilities in Afghanistan, it wouldn't apply on ships that we float around our prisoners we pick up in Africa, they're going to be able to torture people overseas, and they're going to do it. And they may not do it soon. They may be doing some of it now, but it opens the door widely. It just opens it up. And if you look at it in the context of having failed to prosecute any single one of the architects of the torture regime or any of the key people carrying it out, Bush, Cheney, the whole crowd, Rumsfeld, they're all out there. And so torture is essentially a political football, and they're leaving it open.
I would add another context, Michael. You could add that by following the career of John Brennan, who's now the head of the CIA, but who years ago was one of the guys that was active in the torture program. And when Obama was elected, his name was put up as a guy that should be the head of the CIA. Because of his association with the torture program, he didn't make the cut the first time, but the second time he did. John Brennan was the guy that would sit with Obama every Tuesday and go over a list of people that they would consider to be candidates for assassination. Every Tuesday, they called it Terror Tuesdays. And after that, the guy was promoted to the head of the CIA. So another indication of the power of the CIA.
I mean, that Brennan is in there is shocking. It's absolutely shocking.
Would a more honest approach, Michael, be to withdraw the U.S.'s name as a signator to the Convention Against Torture?
That's interesting, Heidi, because I think it's likely, I don't know this for a fact, that the U.S. is the only country in the world that says that, or may say, that the prohibition on torture or what cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment doesn't apply outside their sovereign country. I think it's probably the only one who's ever even considering that. And you think about it. I mean, here the U.S., so-called, is the most powerful country in the world. What kind of message is that saying to every other country who might be running detention facilities all over the world? It's a particularly bad Obama debate decision. And, you know, one of the contexts I think about it is something we've talked about here before, which is force feeding at Guantanamo. Right now, as we speak, there was a trial just completed on whether force feeding, you know, with those big fat tubes and strapping them into the chair and extracting people from the cells, whether that constitutes a torture or a form of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. That trial is just completed. The judge is going to make a ruling pretty soon. Guantanamo, according to various administrations, is outside the United States. The argument that was made by John Yoo and others was that the torture convention didn't apply because it's outside the United States. So is what's going on here a fear by the United States or by some officials that, my gosh, force feeding may be considered torture by this judge or cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. And the torture convention requires countries to criminalize that kind of torture and to prosecute people for it. So it's conceivable that that's what's going on here in part. But when you ask me, is the U.S. currently engaging in torture? I'm sorry I didn't answer it right, because clearly, what's going on at Guantanamo with force feeding is torture. It's not just torture that Obama has given a pass on and allowed the torturers to not just escape scot-free, but continue to run the government, as Michael Smith said, with people like John Brennan heading the CIA. But of course, the drone program, what we would better call the assassination program, is very high up, from drones to other kinds of assassinations. It's one of the key techniques used by the Obama administration to get rid of its so-called enemies. And Michael, I know you just came back from Argentina, where I don't think they've used a drone yet, or an assassination yet, at least not that we know of, but there's some talk about that in Argentina.
Yes, Michael, as you and Heidi know, I was there to promote the Spanish edition. They've translated the book that we did, Michael, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Assassinated Che Guevara. Years ago, Michael, you were smart enough to make a FOIA request, and you got some documents, and then years later, you got even more documents, and we were able to analyze the documents, publish them in English 3 years ago, to prove for the first time that it was the CIA, the American government, working through the CIA with its ally, the Bolivian dictatorship. It was the American CIA that, in fact, murdered Che Guevara. So the book was translated into Spanish, and I went down there 3 weeks ago to publicize it on the 47th anniversary of his assassination. And the week before I got down there, you know, the United States is insisting that the Argentinian government pay 100% on the dollar on its sovereign debt from years ago. The Argentinians had renegotiated the debt, and there's a vulture fund guy named Paul Singer in the United States that wants 100 cents on the dollar for what he paid pennies on the dollar for these bonds. So they got a federal court in the United States to say that the guy should be paid 100% on the dollar, and it's having a destabilizing effect on the Argentinian economy. So the president of Argentina, the week before I got down there, said, they're the United States trying to destabilize our economy, and moreover, if I get assassinated, don't look east, look north. And she was referencing the well-known history of the CIA in its assassination program, which years ago they used to hide. They didn't want to admit that they killed Che. Now they openly do it through their drone program and brag about it. So the right wing in Argentina was making fun of the president, and the reporters were very interested, in my opinion. I said, you know, her fears are well grounded. And we had long discussions. I met with reporters back to back for 3 days about the history of the CIA involvement in the killing of Che. Of course, Che is the storied son of Argentina. Although he was one of the leaders of the Cuban Revolution, he was Argentinian. He went to medical school right around the corner from where I was staying in Buenos Aires. So the Argentinians were extremely interested in Che, and they're interested in the United States and what it's doing to them. And one of the questions they always ask me was, well, what influence do you think Che has on people today in the world? And I would answer that, of course, amongst young people, Che is viewed upon as someone who not only believed in justice, but fought for it, tried to do something about it, to try to make for a better world. But amongst the countries in Latin America, his spirit has shown a new sense of independence in these countries and a new sense of solidarity. And the week before I was there, the Argentinians brought a motion in front of the human rights organization in Geneva, the UN organization, to condemn the United States for their pursuing the Argentinian economy with this vulture fund. And the vote was amazing, because in the old days, Cuba was totally isolated. A country like Argentina would have been totally isolated. Well, this time, Venezuela and Brazil, the two biggest economies in Latin America, supported the Argentinians against the United States. The vote was 30-5, and the only countries that voted with America were the rich countries, England, France, Germany, Japan. You know, so there's a new sense of solidarity and independence in Latin America, and I think that's one of the legacies of Che Guevara.
Last week, the Pennsylvania State Senate, in a bipartisan 37-11 vote, approved the so-called Revictimization Release Act. This last-minute controversial law was ignited by Mumia Abu-Jamal's commencement address at Goddard College in Vermont. The law would grant crime victims or prosecutors acting on their behalf a civil action against an offender to seek damages, to prevent offenders or former inmates from engaging in conduct that would cause, quote, temporary or permanent state of mental anguish to the victim. Mumia Abu-Jamal is now 60 years old, having spent half of his life on death row. Now in general population, he's written 7 books, with 2 more coming this year, over 3,000 articles, and has given speeches at numerous colleges. We're joined today by Pennsylvania attorney Brett Grody, a member of the Russell Maroon Schoetz legal team and co-founder of the Abolitionist Law Center. Brett Grody, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Hey, Heidi. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, we've had you on a lot to talk about the case of Russell Maroon Schoetz, but I think all three hosts are astonished, to put it lightly, at a new law that has passed in Pennsylvania, and that's what we'd like to talk about today. That would be the Revictimization Release Act, as it's called.
I think it's better labeled the Muzzle Mumia Act.
What does the law do, Brett? This is Michael Ratner speaking.
The Muzzle Mumia Law, as it was called by the Harrisburg Patriots, provides a cause of action for a victim of a personal injury crime to sue an offender in state court in Pennsylvania if that offender engages in conduct that, quote, perpetuates the effect of the crime on the victim. Later on in the statute, it's a very short statute, that conduct is defined as including conduct that causes a temporary or permanent state of mental anguish. It also provides for the district attorney where the conviction was secured or the state's attorney general to essentially act as the private attorney for victim in order to bring this suit. So use state money, taxpayer resources, and this can...
Okay, you know, let me just say, does this...
Let me see, law school.
Let me see if I get the essence of the law, because I think we're so shocked. We covered this law a couple weeks ago when it was proposed, and we said, this is ridiculous. This can never pass, because how we read this and see if we're right, if, let's say, Mumia says something about the crime that he was falsely accused of and put in prison for, and that causes some kind of anguish to, let's say, the family of the policeman who was killed or who died, and they can then sue Mumia or stop him from talking about the crime because it might cause anguish to the family?
You're correct. The law is written so broadly that the Harrisburg Patriot, again, this is mainstream press in Pennsylvania, noted that it could encompass conduct such as breathing, and for many people who have been victimized, the offender's continuing to live causes mental anguish. It also does encompass not only speech about the crime, whether it's somebody like Mumia or Lorenzo Johnson or countless others who speak out about being framed up in Pennsylvania, but it doesn't even make any sort of exceptions for legal proceedings. And obviously, people appealing criminal convictions can cause anguish to others. There are absolutely no standards and no definition for the conduct that is at issue, except in relation to its impact on the victim. And to provide some context, as I'm sure your listeners know, why it was written this way is because they needed to write a statute that would encompass, that would sweep so broadly, so as to encompass things like Mumia giving a commencement address at Goddard College, which was used as the pretext for whipping up this this frenzy within the state legislature.
Slow down for 1 second. So Mamiya gave a speech at Goddard College.
The commencement address.
Right, and people were very upset. Some of the
police.
Cops and others were very upset. And so they passed a law that arguably, from their point of view, they'd be able to stop Mamiya from giving that speech because it would might cause or cause anguish to the family of the police officer who died. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
So this is a prior restraint on freedom of speech. Is that right?
Well, it's written so it is a prior restraint on freedom of speech, but it's written so broadly that it, you know, Maureen Faulkner or the district attorney of Philadelphia, Seth Williams, could conceivably go into court under this law and try to shut down any of Mumia's commentaries, book publishing, things which circulate in the public domain and attract a lot of attention and publicity for him and, you know, his viewpoints and his considerable talent. And this, if this causes anguish, you know, they can try to shut that down.
Now, Brett, could this conceivably be extended to supporters of Mumia or other political prisoners who are outspoken in the media or at public venues, do you think?
Conceivably. The House Judiciary Committee in Pennsylvania, in discussing this law when it was introduced in committee, raised the issue of would this allow a court to enjoin what they called third-party vessels? So, for instance, prison radio, or it could be an individual who's authorized to speak to the media or make a public statement. If, you know, they are carrying out messages from somebody in prison, then at least the people who wrote the legislation and passed it thought that it could reach third-party conduct in order to enjoin them from transmitting messages.
You know, Brett, you know what's so astounding to Heidi and Michael and me is that anybody that goes to law school for 60 days knows this is outrageous. And here, these legislatures, both houses in Pennsylvania, plus the governor, most of these people are lawyers. And they knuckled under to the Fraternal Order of Police and did it because they want their votes. And that's a powerful organization, the Fraternal Order of Police. I mean, how do you explain this?
How did it happen?
Yeah.
Michael's question. How did it happen?
It wasn't really that complicated. The governor, Seth Williams, the Department of Corrections secretary, a number of legislators got in the media, you know, became self-righteous in their outrage. The Fraternal Order of Police snapped their fingers, and a law was written and passed in less than 2 weeks. And it was passed 197-0 in the House.
Whoa.
And 37-11 in the Senate. And it just shows that what takes precedence over any sort of adherence to the Constitution of the state or the United States, or to any other law, is allegiance to power amongst the political class. And Pennsylvania politicians, attorney generals, et cetera, district attorneys, are no strangers to committing constitutional violations. It's a normative practice for them.
I mean, allegiance to power is one thing. Allegiance to power on a patently unconstitutional law is something else. I mean, it just has, you know, shades of when, you know, the parliaments in Germany voted in fascism. I mean, it's like that kind of situation.
Yeah, it just was not even thought out kind of with an aim towards trying to fit it within existing jurisprudence.
Brett, do you think this could be model legislation for other states? I should say ill-advised model legislation?
You know, if the courts the federal courts are as willing to kowtow out of the Fraternal Order of Police's line, but it's our intention to shut this down.
Well, how are you involved right now?
So right now I'm representing Mumia in this and Prison Radio and Robert Salim Holbrook, who's a juvenile lifer and Human Rights Coalition member and activist and writer. And we're also working with another legal organization similar to the Abolitionist Law Center, the Amistad Law Project, a new group in Philadelphia, and we're talking with other counsel and with other potential parties, and there's certainly going to be legal action. It's unconstitutional under traditional overbreadth analysis. It penalizes lawful speech, and it's void for vagueness. It's not just lack of explicit standards for the conduct involved. It gives no standards.
There's no such tort action, never mind the First Amendment suffocation, but just in the law of torts, that is an injury to somebody, either to their body or to their reputation. There's no such tort action in American or British law. I mean, they've really cooked one up.
Yeah, I mean, even with something like it that would maybe be closest to what they were getting at, the intentional infliction of emotional distress, because it goes to that issue of mental anguish, there needs to be conduct directed by the one party at the other. Just to show how this has nothing to do with actually providing any sort of relief for victims, there is probably nothing that would be more traumatizing for an actual victim of a crime than to have to go through this process that they've laid out in the Re-Victimization Relief Act. So, for instance, they have made the victim's state of mind an element of the cause of action that needs to be proven to get an injunction, which therefore means that their medical history, their mental health history, the medications they're on, their subjective state of mind is open to discovery processes, depositions, cross-examinations by attorneys for the person who is the offender that supposedly wronged them. And it's hard to imagine a more nightmarish situation for actual victims.
Right. Brett, during this process, did legislators give examples of any other inmates other than Mumia Abu-Jamal inciting the need for this?
No, they did not. And the most that I heard of any type of other example given was somebody from the Office of Victims Advocate stating that unnamed people inside state prisons would call up and record statements of the names and addresses of victims of sexual violence that they had harmed. Publicize these. They didn't provide any specific examples, and, I'm skeptical as to whether or not there are any, but they explicitly and exclusively focused on Mumia.
We're speaking with Pennsylvania attorney Brett Grody of the Abolitionist Law Center. Brett is representing Mumia. I wanted to ask you, Brett, because this is so troubling, tell us about the Fraternal Order of Police and what kind of clout they have. Who are their members? Where are they? Are they just a Pennsylvania outfit? I mean, how do they pull this off?
Well, the Fraternal Order of Police is a national organization. I'm not, an expert in the Fraternal Order of Police, but I know enough to know that, this legislation was introduced by a former member of theirs, Mike Varib, who was a former Philadelphia police officer, is now a state legislature. In the context of Mumia's case, they have been leading a lynch mob, literally, in the streets to seek to snuff out his voice for decades. The judge that presided over his trial was a former Fraternal Order of Police member. They finance and, vet the campaigns of every Supreme Court justice in the state of Pennsylvania. And they same with people that are running for office for governors. And they have a national agenda as well. And right now, that national agenda is seriously being called into question for the to the greatest extent in my lifetime. I'm 32 years old. And the role of police and other institutions of state violence in the imperial prison states in this era of mass incarceration is being questioned now more than ever in the wake of Ferguson. And Mumia is being used in this context in an attempt to reestablish the narrative that the Fraternal Order of Police, the police officers, their political counterparts, are righteous protectors of public safety and that they're beyond question and beyond reproach. They're trying to, reset the propaganda line that has been dislodged in the wake of the rebellions in Ferguson.
Brett, when the law was signed by the governor, it was done so on the spot where Mumia was shot and Officer Faulkner was shot. That seems to codify the fact that this really is a Mumia-specific piece of legislation.
Yes, absolutely. It was 13th and Locust in Philadelphia, which is where Officer Faulkner died, and where the police that arrived on the scene immediately began fabricating a case to put this on Mumia. It's far too involved to get into right now, but going through all the evidence and the trial record in the case and the appellate record shows that if there's one version of events that is unequivocally false and disproven, it's the prosecution's version. And, that's fitting in an ironic sense that the governor in the Fraternal Order of Police would revisit the site which has been the spawn of such horrific and malicious lies in order to try to reestablish their own authority. And in the case of Governor Corbett, his flagging and doomed electoral hopes.
I'm interested in the opposition to this law as it was going through and what groups were opposed to it. I assume, although I'm not 100%, was the ACLU opposed to it? Were there other sort of free speech, civil liberties groups that actually took a stand on it? I'm asking really because I would normally expect them to, but I know that Mumia is anathema to some people, as you can see, in Pennsylvania, and I've had my own experiences with that. But I'm just, what was the opposition like?
The opposition was those who are consistently challenging the prison system, so Mumia supporters, the Decarcerate PA folks, Human Rights Coalition, and just a number of assorted prisoners and their family members I know personally were calling in quite a lot to try to intervene in some way. The ACLU was very publicly opposed to this legislation and has been quoted in the press many times, and I was listening to their legislative director in an interview very clearly stating that this commencement address that they're supposedly up in arms against is constitutionally protected conduct. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. They even circulated, the ACLU did, a memo to legislators stating the only people this law is going to benefit are the attorneys that, you know, get it overturned in federal court. But, you know, besides that, right, besides those who are consistently challenging the system, the ACLU, there wasn't too much opposition. There were a few state senators, Shirley Kitchen, Jay Costa, Daylon Leach, who spoke out against it and voted no.
I understand, Brett, that at the actual signing, a group of opponents, activists who've worked on behalf of Mumia for years, were so vocal that bystanders said they couldn't hear any of the official proceedings.
Yeah, I heard the same thing and was just reading about that and seeing some wonderful images of Pam and Ramona Africa, and I think Tony Montero was there. It seems that even this kind of this stage production of the governor, they couldn't even pull this off competently.
Brett, Mumia has been in prison about as long as you've been on this planet. And
yeah.
You had a chance to meet him. And I wanted to ask you what it was like when you went down to prison and met Mumia.
You know, I'd have to go back quite some time to 2008 when I first started visiting prisons, and he was in SCI Green on death row. So I've been seeing him on and off, you know, times for, I guess, 6 years now. And it's remarkable in so many ways. It's hard to capture. There's the feeling of the oppressive atmosphere of the institution, yet when you leave from a visit with Mumia, there's a sadness in having to leave, really in having to leave that facility without him and the people that you leave behind. But he's a remarkably warm, caring, funny, incisive person. And when I saw him last week and we were discussing this legislation, I can assure you that he is ready to rumble on this one and ready to go into court and get another victory in the First Amendment context.
I wanted to ask you about the organization that you work for, the Abolitionist Law Center. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Abolitionist Law Center was something I co-founded with Dustin McDaniel, who's another Pitt Law grad that I met here in Pittsburgh, my last year in law school, so February 2013. And our mission is to practice movement lawyering in a context that seeks to abolish race and class-based mass incarceration and to use litigation, report writing, investigation, activism, organizing, etc., in a diverse array of strategies to further this. So we have a number of cases in the courts, including solitary confinement cases like Russell Maroon Schultz and a suicide case. We're investigating a prison that's actually literally built in the midst of a massive coal waste dump. We and have a number of other assorted cases and projects we're working at, and now we have had another First Amendment case thrown our way.
And Brett, it's so wonderful to have you involved in this case, as well as in all the other prisoners' rights cases that you've taken on.
Yeah, it's great. It reminds us, all three of us, of our best days as young movement lawyers, which makes me envious. So I'm really glad you're doing the work.
You say you're 32. I'm 72. And it's wonderful to see that we were able to pass the torch to you.
Yeah, I appreciate you all for having me on. People can learn more about, you know, our cases and projects at www.abolitionistlawcenter.org.
Keep up the great work, and we look forward to having you on again.
Thanks, Brett.
Bye.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Go now to hear excerpts from a presentation by Richard Falk, with an introduction by Rashid Khalidi, titled The Palestinian Future After Gaza. Richard Falk was presenting at the Edward W. Said Memorial Lecture, co-sponsored by Columbia's Heyman Center for the Humanities. It's given once a year in honor of the public intellectual and literary critic Edward W. Said, who taught in the English and Comparative Literature Department at Columbia from 1963 to 2003. Richard Falk is a professor of international law and practice at Princeton University. We go now to hear excerpts from his presentation.
You can only imagine how, starting in 2008, the year in which Operation Cast Lead began, the attack on Gaza from the December of 2008 through January of 2009, and continuing for 6 years through a little more than a year ago, what kind of circumstances Richard Falk found himself in. He was obliged by his training, by his humanity, by his knowledge of the law to call a spade a spade. And he did so with forthrightness, with honesty, and received a deluge of vituperation that no human being should have to endure. And I want you to think of this as you listen to him this evening. This is the voice not only of learning and knowledge of the law and of various other things. I'm going to read a few of the titles so you see precisely what I'm talking about. But someone who has spent 6 years trying to apply these principles in the most difficult of circumstances. In the past 50 years, little under 50 years, Richard Falk has written and edited over 25 books. That's a book every 2 years. But four of them are multi-volume works. Four volumes, five volumes. In fact, if you count it in volumes, it's a book every year and a bit. These include, and I'm just going to read some of the titles, The Role of Domestic Courts in the International Legal Order, The Strategy of World Order, Legal Order in a Violent World. Think of these titles when you think of what he was doing as a UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine. The Status of Law in International Society. The Vietnam War and International Law. That was a four-volume work. The kind of knowledge and learning which most of the time is cooped up in the academy and actually applied it to the real world. He has found that his training, his background, his knowledge are things that actually are needed in the world. And he's gone out in spite of extraordinary pressure on him not to do so, and, as I said before, called a spade a spade. This is a man who is a very distinguished successor to some very distinguished speakers in this series. So I ask you to join me in welcoming Richard Falk.
I should be quite angry at Rashid for introducing me in a way that I'm sure I can't live up to, but I'll forgive him. So to appreciate Edward's rejection of Oslo as a framework for peace, it is necessary to consider what was wrong about it from a Palestinian viewpoint. I would point to five features. First of all, the fragmentation of the West Bank into areas A, B, and C, making untenable territorial coherence during the period of occupation. Secondly, the idea that Palestinian goals may be achieved on the basis of Israeli consent, despite already in 1967 the United Nations Security Council unanimously mandated a withdrawal from the territory occupied during the 1967 war. Thirdly, the designation of the United States as the permanent intermediary for these negotiations, despite its partisan alignment with Israel, which already was in the driver's seat from a diplomatic perspective. And fourth, and maybe most important of all, the exclusion of international law and the authority of the United Nations from the negotiating process, which was the Palestinian trump in their political deck of cards. International law was clearly on the side of Palestinians in relation to their main claims and grievances. This included borders, refugees, settlements, Jerusalem, and water, as well as the day-to-day practices associated with the occupation itself. Without the inclusion of Palestinian rights under international law, diplomacy degenerates into a bargaining process, which ensures that power disparities will be embodied in any negotiated solution, and a heavily slanted, one-sided outcome in Israel's favor would be falsely proclaimed as peace. Even Palestinian objections to continuing Israeli settlement expansion as unlawful were rebuffed by Washington as unhelpful obstructions to the supposed peace process. The Palestinian humiliation was most vividly expressed by their acceptance of the 1993 Declaration of Principles that did not even refer to the Palestinian inalienable right of self-determination. Fifth and finally, the perverse deepening of such an exclusion by acquiescing in Israel's unlawful activities as being validated outside the negotiating framework. For instance, by George W. Bush's letter to Ariel Sharon in April 2004 to the effect that the U.S. government agrees that any end of the conflict must include the incorporation of the settlement blocks into Israel's territory. Hillary Clinton, while Obama's Secretary of State, added to this hegemonic sanitation of illegality, calling the settlement phenomenon, quote unquote, subsequent developments that must be acknowledged by the Palestinians if they genuinely sought peace. The unreasonableness of the deconstructed Oslo approach as a means to achieve a just peace is accentuated, in my view, by the prior unheralded forthcomingness of the PLO in its earlier endorsement of the 1988 Palestinian National Council decision to recognize Israel within its 67 borders. Such a bold unilateral initiative, supported by Edward when announced, in effect gave up the PLO's earlier refusal to accept the existence of Israel in any form, and it exhibited a willingness to swallow a territorial arrangement that accorded the Palestinians only 22% of historic Palestine. As is well known, this was less than half of what the UN in the partition plan of 1947 had offered, which at the time seemed grossly unfair given the relative size of the Jewish and Palestinian populations. The fact that such a unilateral diplomatic initiative by the Palestinians failed to yield any acknowledgement at all from Israel, much less some sort of reciprocal gesture, raises deep doubts as to whether even then, when a far more moderate leadership existed in Tel Aviv, was there any real Israeli interest in achieving a two-state solution? This seems accurate despite the verbal assurances to the contrary over the years, including by Netanyahu, while at the same time taking a variety of steps that make the possibility of a Palestinian viable sovereign state less and less attractive to the Palestinians. These elements of the overall situation are descriptive of the defeatist period of the Palestinian intergovernmental posture that seemed ready to settle for arrangements that disregarded Palestinian rights under international law. There was considerable anxiety among Palestinian intellectuals around the Clinton initiative in 2000 that Arafat might make a deal that accepted the settlements and relinquished the rights of several million Palestinian refugees. In fact, the Second Intifada was interpreted at the time as a warning, as much a warning to the PLO as it was a rebuff of Israel. There were further disquieting developments in this period: massive settlement expansion, a refusal by Israel to respect the 2004 World Court findings calling for the dismantling of the separation wall, an apartheid structure of occupation in the West Bank, a process of incremental ethnic cleansing in East Jerusalem, and a harsh regime of collective punishment imposed on Gaza that featured three Israeli campaigns of state terror against a caged population in the course of the last 6 years. These attacks on Gaza, of warlike ferocity, that were unprecedented in locking the civilian population into the combat zone, disallowing even women and children to claim refugee status by crossing the border or seeking secure sanctuary within Gaza. Yet these dispiriting realities are far from the whole story of Palestinian resistance and struggle. The formal leadership of Palestine may have taken the defeatist route, but Palestinians as a people, by and large, kept their faith in the necessity of resistance and of not giving up their long quest for a sustainable and just peace. We need to remember that Edwards rejected the defeatist interpretation of the Palestinian lost cause, and in the process transferred his energies from the bankruptcy of top-down diplomacy to the empowering potential of bottom-up, people-oriented civil society militancy. This shift can be situated most dramatically in 1987, the time of the First Intifada, a mobilization of Palestinian resistance that was nonviolent yet withheld all cooperation from the occupier. It was reinforced by the Second Intifada in 2000 that was again, in part, a populist reaction to Israeli policies but lacked the nonviolent discipline of the earlier uprising. In 2005, a joint appeal from 170 Palestinian civil society organizations to launch a global boycott and divestment and sanctions campaign with its own defined political goals was a step toward resituating the national Palestinian movement. It represented a further shift in the direction of civil society leadership and toward a movement of global solidarity that has been gaining momentum in the last couple of years. This momentum was further accelerated by the moral outrage generated by the Israeli 50-day attack on Gaza that commenced in July of this year. This reaction seemed especially strong in Western Europe. What seemed a defining moment in 1993 has now been superseded by a recent cluster of events, a new defining moment in 2014, which involves a reformulation of perceptions in relation to the Palestinian struggle. In some ways, the situation from the Palestinian perspective has never seemed darker, undoubtedly making the cynical realist write off the conflict in even more strident language. The direct talks between Israel and the Palestinians have collapsed, and the lack of commitment by the Netanyahu government has been made explicit. The Israeli Knesset recently elected Reuven Rivlin as the 10th president of Israel, and he is, for the first time in such a high position, an outspoken advocate of incorporating the whole of the West Bank into Israel, along with Jerusalem, and implementing an Israeli one-state solution that fulfills the maximalist version of the Zionist project. Rivlin, unlike Netanyahu, believes that the oppression of the Palestinians should be eased, provided that they agree to live in law-abiding peace within a Jewish state that would once and for all extinguish Palestinian political dreams. Distressingly, also, the Arab countries in this recent conflict actually sided with Israel because of their own priorities directed at defeating grassroots Islamically oriented political movements in the region. And then Israeli public opinion, according to the Israeli peace activist and political figure Yuri Avneri, was 99% behind the fury of the attacks. Others noted high-level and populist incitement to genocide during the conduct of Operation Protective Edge. Once more, Gaza was devastated by attacks that killed more than 2,100 Palestinians, injured another 11,000, and traumatized the entire population, which was, as I suggested, locked into the combat zone with no means of escape. And the U.S. Congress remains as unconditionally committed to Israel as ever. To express its defiance of public opinion, Israel announced very dramatic settlement expansions that included the seizure of 1,000 acres of strategically located land between southern Jerusalem and Bethlehem, bisecting any prospective possible Palestinian state, and added 26 housing units to its approved list of what settlements could do to expand. This pattern of developments reveals an Israel facing little diplomatic pressure to resolve the conflict by negotiations and no incentive on its own to do so. For Palestine, there exists only a fragile unity between the PLO and Hamas and a debilitating dependence on Israel and the United States for the funds needed to maintain order in the territories under their administrative control. Yet in the face of this, one of the most brilliant Palestinian analysts of the conflict, Ali Abu Nima, writes these startling sentences at the very beginning of his fine new book, The Struggle for Justice in Palestine, and I quote, "The Palestinians are winning. This might seem like hubris or even insensitivity. After all, in so many ways, things have never looked worse." We must ask, what does Abu Nima mean by winning, and what basis can he have for being hopeful while being keenly aware of the dire situation facing the Palestinians? Abu Nima is, in effect, telling my French diplomat to look deeper at the overall picture if he wants to understand the true reality of the situation. It is not a matter of how long you look that matters, but what you see. And what should we see? There are a few factors to consider: the discrediting of Oslo, the growth of the global solidarity movement, the moves toward Palestinian political unity, the recognition of Israeli criminality and American complicity as increasing pressures on the Palestinian Authority to take their complaints to the International Criminal Court, and growing evidence that Israel is more worried about what it calls the delegitimation project than about the threats posed by Palestinian armed resistance. And finally, the upsurge of regional extremism in the Middle East that could at some point undermine Israel's security. What Abu Nima sees that the realist, unblinkered vision misses are the legitimacy and psychopolitical dimensions of conflict that are so crucial in our post-colonial world. These dimensions center on the powerful mobilizing impact on a population of a denial of its inalienable right of self-determination and other elemental rights. This is particularly so, as in the Palestinian case, if the denial rests on colonialist patterns of occupation that are partially sustained by links to geopolitical actors, in this instance, the United States. Let me end with a reaffirmation of the complex relationship between our limited knowledge, especially of the future, and our political and moral will that has the irreducible freedom to create its own horizons. It is for this reason alone that it seems empowering to join with Edward Said and Zizek in declaring that our defense of lost causes, in this instance that of the Palestinian people, who have endured an unspeakable ordeal of victimization for so long, as in South Africa, where in the end the racist white elites were able to remain after the collapse of the apartheid regime, it will take a comparable political miracle to reach a just and sustainable peace in Palestine that upholds the equal dignity of both peoples. In this spirit, I end with the enigmatic plea of the poet W.H. Auden. We who are about to die demand a miracle. Thank you very much.
That was Richard Falk speaking at the Edward Said Memorial Lecture.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.